This is lecture 9. We are, remarkably enough, and I cannot congratulate myself enough for this, on time, which is very good. So we have a full 3 lectures to cover part 4, which is back to the physics of GR, so the in a sense the intellectual payoff of the weeks up to now. Before we get started on that, however, a couple of things about supervisions. For historical reasons, the way that the GR course had been covered by supervisions has been different from the other courses. It's been a separate supervision sessions rather than small group supervisions. But there's some flux in the way these will all be managed. And it has occurred to me that it might be useful to have... I haven't previously done office hours, but either an office hour I could sort of announce, or else, as some others have done for the honours courses, bookable slots at a certain time. Does anyone have any feelings about this, or any suggestions on this sort of topic? Is that a good idea, or is that a bad idea? Of those two possible models, which one is an obviously better one, or any? Yeah? Okay. Does anyone think otherwise? Okay, then what I'll do is I'll identify a suitable time. I don't really know your timetables. Are the afternoons out? Or are the mornings out? Or is there an obviously bad time to organise, to suggest an office hour? Anyone? I don't know your timetables.
Between 10 and 12 is normally bad.
Is normally bad?
10 and 12 is normally bad.
Bad, okay. So... if I said picked 1 o'clock one day, would that be a suitable sort of? I'm seeing sort of nods. Okay, I'll have a think about that and sort that out. I think that is all. Are there any other questions or thoughts or anxieties to do with this that you have? Anxieties not to do with this are excluded. Okay, then let's get going. Before I do that, I will just mention a couple of things about the very end of part 3. At the end, we're racing for the finish line, as it were. And I skipped through the bit on geodesic deviation, but there's a couple of things I do want to just mention. I won't work through the derivation of this or the corroboration. I'll ask you either to look in the notes or just take it on trust. The point of geodesic deviation is, you might remember this picture from part 1. We talked about the idea of two things falling toward the centre of the Earth. And because they are falling toward the centre of the Earth, they are heading toward the same point. And so... although they are both in free fall, each of the two observers at either end of that, well, say, spaceship or whatever, will see the distance to the other one decrease at an increasing rate. They will be, strictly in quotes, accelerating toward each other in the specific sense that the second derivative of their separation will be non-zero. But they will not be accelerating. They will not be feeling any push if they were holding a plumb bob. But that wouldn't work. If they were holding some sort of accelerometer, then they wouldn't detect anything as they were falling, even though they were. There's a second derivative of being non-zero happening here. And that is because these two observers at either end of the spaceship or train carriage or whatever you want to call it are both following geodesics, but those geodesics, the separation between those geodesics is changing as a function, as a quite complicated function of time, because of the curvature of the space they're falling through. And we're going to talk about the relationship between curvature and gravity in a moment, but so just like jumping ahead of ourselves, the gravity that this Earth, this planet here, has is has the consequence that the space-time around it is curved in a way we'll learn about shortly. And so as those particles fall geodesic through it, those geodesics are straight lines in the space, but nonetheless curved. And so it's tidal effects like this, so-called tidal effects, that are where the effects of gravity emerge. That's the picture I used to set up the scamper through the last couple of pages of the note. The idea was, you recall, that there were multiple geodesics, and we were able to... This is another version of what we stepped through fairly painfully in the last lecture, of taking a vector for a walk around a closed path. In this case, the end result of that calculation would have been, if we'd gone through it step by step, would have been a calculation of how much this connecting vector at the top, which links points with equal parameter on the two geodesics, how much that changes. And the answer, jumping to the end, was an expression like this, which I want to put up here so that I can refer to it later on when we can use that expression in a simple case. All it's saying is that the second derivative of the separation between the points on two neighbouring geodesics, separation is a function of the tangents to the geodesics. The separation itself, you know, pointing here to here, and the Riemann tensor. So the reason why this emerges naturally at the end of part three is this is another case where the Riemann tensor is telling us what we want to know about the shape of the space that we're going through. And this time it's telling us stuff about the change that this connecting vector. This connecting vector here, how much that changes because of the curvature of the space that these geodesics are limiting. So we'll see an example of that geodesic deviation equation in not the lecture after this one, when you will be illuminated, I hope. Key points. Any questions about that? So I acknowledge I have effectively missed a bit out there because the details are less important than the conclusion. So, onward. So here, we're back to physics, and the two things I want to cover, really, in this part are, first of all, the equivalence principle. We touched on the equivalence principle in part one, where I said that all free-falling inertial frames are equivalent for the performance of all physical experiments. I think I actually said that in part one. If I didn't, then I probably ought to have done. But you'll probably have seen that expressed somewhere. And we find that we're able now to put some mathematical flesh on the physical bones of that statement. That of the equivalence principle. So we see where the, as it were, to use an overused image, this is where the rubber hits the road, as it were. And my goal, the overall goal of this of GRG1 is to get to the point where we can write down Einstein's equations and say, that's the question, now go and answer it. But it's unfair to do that and not give a solution to Einstein's equations, and which describes a space-time of interest to us, and the one we look at is how we can recover Newton's theory of gravity from Einstein's theory. So as the low energy, low speed limit of an Einsteinian theory of gravity. This is challenging, as I've said before. The point of the objectives, unlike the aims, are closely linked to assessment, and this is challenging to assess because all the calculations are hideously long. So the assessment tends to be explain X, and show that you understand X, basically. Persuade me that you have a clue type assessment rather than other things. But there are some simple dynamical calculations that you'll be able to do in certain contexts. There are some simple calculations that are possible at the end of this. Okay. In Newton's gravity, the source of gravity is matter, it's mass. The one of the terms in Newton's theory of Newton's law of universal gravitation. Well, two of the terms are m's. They're masses. So it's no surprise that it's a mass that we have to think about and deal with in this context. However, this being relativity, we can't talk about mass. The natural thing instead is to talk about energy momentum. So it's not just the mass of something, but the energy, the momentum it has by virtue of its movement. So when something is moving rapidly, there's more energy momentum in it, and so it gravitates more, is what we're going to discover. We shouldn't be surprised at that, because it's the energy momentum, the momentum four vector, that is the key, the thing that's important in your study of relativity. And the way we edge up on, so we'll have to learn how to talk about the energy momentum in extended objects in a relativistically satisfactory way. The way we do that is we talk about dust. Before I do that, I want to just check I'm not missing something out here. I've the nasty feeling there's some remark I might want to make sure I made early. So just a minor thing. At this point, up to this point, we've been talking about n dimensions. Of course, the reason we're talking about n dimensions is to turn into n equals 4. And so from now on, we're talking about four dimensions with signature of space-time, which in this case would be minus plus plus plus. And I'm not going to use, for indexes, I'm going to switch to using Greek indexes for space-time dimensions 0, 1, 2, 3, and Latin ones for space-only ones. That's just a slight notational tweak to fit in with the conventions. Okay, so dust. Matter is structured. There are all sorts of things that, there are whole disciplines devoted to the structure of matter. That's complication. You can simplify that and talk about a perfect fluid, which is something with no viscosity, but which has mass density, and has pressure. And you can simplify that still further by talking of dust, which in this context is something which has no internal structure, so that it has no viscosity, and it's all there's a frame in which it is at rest, so there's no pressure. So and the idea is a collection of dust particles. So this is something which has mass density and nothing else. Okay. So let's imagine a box of this. So it's a box of with length delta x, delta y, delta z. And you can now imagine it being moving at some constant speed with respect to it, or we're moving at some constant speed with respect to it. Now, that box will therefore length contract, as your recollection of special relativity will immediately remind you. So I want to go through this in careful order. So the volume in the other frame with delta x prime, well, delta y prime, delta z primed, with an extra factor of I get this upside down. No, you. With an extra factor of gamma, but that's the usual Lorentz factor. So the thing will length contract, so the volume will go down by a factor of gamma, which means the density goes up by a factor. The number density goes up by a factor of gamma. So if there is a, if we look at this, and ask what is the flux of particles through the end wall of this, where this thing is moving with respect to it, I think the perspective is wrong in that. I think it's actually, I need to redraw that. I cannot tolerate the perspective being wrong. But, then the flux of particles through this, the end wall will be the volume of this dot x dot y dot z divided by the flux is the number per unit area per unit time, which is therefore going to end up with a flux in the x direction being but I'm going to slightly jump to the end, being gamma n vx, where n is the the number density in the rest frame. I'm going to turn off autofocus. Okay. One can go through that in more step by step, but I hope you agree that's reasonable. The point is that the number density is proportional to the velocity, but with an extra factor of gamma because of the increase in the number density because of the length contraction of the side of the box. And that looks sort of familiar. That looks like n times gamma vx. And so we can jump to the conclusion that there is a flux vector here, which is the number density times the full velocity of the motion. So it's not just specific. This is to the x direction. We'll jump into that conclusion. I mean, it will turn out that that's a sensible thing to do. So what I'm doing here is motivating this as an idea. So that's the flux vector. And the components of this are going, therefore going to be gamma n, gamma n vx, gamma n v y, gamma n v z. How do we extract those components of the flux vector? In exactly the usual way, by plugging one of the basis one forms into the flux vector. That's flux vector with the alpha basis one form plugged into it. And here, as I say, I'm switching to using the traditional thing of using Greek letters for the 0 to 3 indexes, and I'll later use Latin letters for the spatial components. So that's I'm just recapitulating stuff that you've seen before about the way we extract components of a vector from the vector itself and one of the basis one forms. Okay. So we've talked about the change in the number density of the particles in the box, and that number density had gone up because the size of the box has gone down using Lorentz contraction. However, there's also because these dust particles in the box are moving at speed, the energy that they have acquires another factor of gamma. So the energy of the particles in the box, let's write down that the energy ends up being gamma n, the increase to the increase in the number density. And if each of these particles has a mass m, which acquires another gamma, the energy in the of the particles in the box has acquired a gamma squared. And that is a hint that we are not going to be able to describe this the energy of the particles in this box by a vector, because by a rank one object, because the transformation of a rank one object from frame to frame would only pick up one factor of gamma, whereas it's clear we need two. So we're going to need a higher rank object. What do we have to build that higher rank object? The things we have available are the momentum four vectors of the dust particles and the overall flux vector. So the momentum of the dust particles is telling us that in another frame, the momentum of those dust particles would change. And we also are told that there is an overall number density corresponding to the flux vector, which will also change. And so those are the two vectors we have to play with. So what we can do is guess, and here I'm motivating again, rather than deducing, that there is a tensor, which is the momentum four vector of the dust particles, outer product with the flux four vector of the particles as a whole, which is going to be M U cross N U from above, which is just rho U cross U, where rho is equal to MN. And in case it's not obvious, M here is the rest mass of the particles and N is the rest density of the particles in the dust. And we can extract components of this tensor in the usual way by applying the basis one forms to it, which end up with being P D X mu times N D X nu. In again illustrating the way that the we evaluate an outer product by plugging the, in this case, one forms, in turn into the two components of the outer product, and simply real number multiplying the results together. So that's an equivalent sign rather than an equal sign, really. Did that? I don't see any looks of shock and horror. That's good. So the thing to do, again, reassuring you that this is a sensible thing to do, is to start looking at the individual components of this object, which is the energy momentum tensor, or the stress energy tensor of the dust. So this is the tensor which I assert is characterizing the energy and momentum of the dust as an assembly, which we are going to discover is the source of the gravitational field. The change to space-time around it. So let's look, for example, at T00, the 00th component. That's P dt times N dt. And the time component of the momentum four vector is gamma m, if you recall your special relativity, and the time component of the flux vector is gamma n, which gives the term that we sort of, in a slightly hand wavy way, deduced earlier on. So that's reassuring. The T0i, and again, this is me using Latin letters to indicate the space components of the tensor. That's so I is 1, 2, or 3. It's going to be P dt n dxi, which will be gamma m and gamma N V I. And if we, you know, that's from here. And if we look at that, that has the dimensions of mass per unit area per unit time. So that is the and mass being in this context the same as energy. That's the energy flow per unit area per unit time. So that's the energy flow across a surface of constant x per unit time. So that's the essentially the mass flow that's being represented by the mass flow of the dust. We can have a similar sort of thing argument for what Ti0 is. That's the spatial component of the momentum and the time component of the dust. And you can, it's possible to reassure yourself that that is the same as T0i. In other words, this tensor is symmetric, it turns out. And we can look at Tij, so the space components of the tensor, which will be equal to P dxi n dxj, which will be m gamma m vi times gamma n vj, which basically from the dimensions ends up being the flux, the flux of momentum per unit area per unit time, which ends up being the force per unit area. There's a slightly fiddly argument here, but that is picking up the force that there would be on a wall of if this body of flux, this body of dust particles hit a wall. That's force per unit area. So more generally, what we're doing here is we're interpreting the various components of this tensor as the flux, the way I put it, the flux of the T alpha beta is the flux of the alpha component of momentum, so energy or momentum, across the beta a surface of constant beta, so surface of constant time, i.e. into the future, or surface of constant position, i.e. The flow, so through the space. Okay. I'm aware this is all slightly hand waving, but it's as I say again, it's intended to motivate the identification of these things rather than deduce them. Now, I said this was a perfect. This was dust. It had no pressure. If we relax that slightly and talk of a perfect fluid, has no preferred direction. So that the spatial part, so that the energy momentum tensor describing that perfect fluid, therefore cannot have any asymmetry. It must be symmetrical in all directions, in all spatial directions. So that for a perfect fluid, the ijth components, the spatial sector of the energy momentum tensor, has to be proportional to the identity matrix. And by comparing what we've just seen is that it's plausible to identify the spatial part of the energy momentum tensor as the as having the dimensions of pressure per unit time, of force per unit time, which is pressure, then the spatial sector is equal to P dot IJ. And for dust, the pressure is zero, therefore the spatial sector is going to be zero. So the angular momentum tensor is very simple. Okay, now, in the... slight hand waving, which I don't like this hand waving, but it's sort of necessary to get to the end point. We can end up concluding that. For a perfect fluid, that the a form for the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid, so that's something which has no viscosity but does have pressure, is ends up taking a very simple form, which is just the U cross U with terms involving the mass density in the rest frame, the pressure. So P here is pressure rather than momentum, slightly unfortunately, with an extra term which is the just the metric. And in the case of dust, where the pressure is zero, that ends up being simply rho zero, zero, zero. For dust, in specifically the momentarily co-moving reference frame, MCRF. So that's a long way of saying that this energy momentum tensor clearly can be quite complicated. There's also things that could be in there. But the key things are the mass that's there, you know, the actual objects there, which are expressed in things like the density, the mass density, and other motion, other sources of energy, such as pressure, which appear when in the case of a fluid, but not in the case of dust. And in the case of dust, that energy momentum tensor becomes, you know, reassuringly simple. It ends up with only one non-zero component in the frame of which it's not moving, and Lorentz transform into other forms similarly. That's that diagonal matrix there. Okay, we'll go on to slightly more substantive things now. Section 412 is another way of arriving at that sort of conclusion, which is more satisfying in some respects and less satisfying in others. This way of getting to that conclusion does, it sort of celebrates our return to physics here by returning to slightly heuristic physical arguments. The other way of approaching this is to talk about the way in which you can describe volumes in a geometrically satisfactory way within relativity using one forms and two forms and similar things. So because one forms, as the clue is in the name, are at the bottom of a tree of more complicated geometrical objects. There's nothing else I want to say about that other alternative approach to this, but it doesn't have a dangerous bend because you might be interested and it's sort of relevant, but I'm not going to say anything more about it just now. Okay. We're doing well. And now what we're going on to is to actually talk about the laws of physics in curved space-time. So this is really where we start to discover how all the maths we've done so far links to the physics of what we want to understand. But before we do that, we do want to make a detour back into maths by defining a couple of extra objects. But they're fairly routine things, so they are just contractions of the Riemann tensor, which turn out to be of more ready significance. So number one is, you take the Riemann tensor, alpha, beta, mu, nu, and contract it over the first and third indexes, then we get an object with, we get a rank 2 object with the two unmatched indexes, which is called the Ricci tensor. So just a contraction of the of the Riemann tensor. You plug two of the components into each other. If we further contract that and take the Ricci tensor and contract over those remaining two indexes, then we get a scalar called the Ricci scalar. And this, from the symmetries of the Riemann tensor that we saw briefly last time, we can deduce that Ricci tensor is symmetric. So R beta nu is equal to R nu beta. We also, last time, discovered that in the local inertial frame, there is an explicit expression for the Ricci tensor, which is in terms of derivatives of the metric. So if we, and this is not obvious, if we ask what about beta mu nu comma lambda and differentiate the Ricci tensor with respect to one of the other coordinate functions, and do so alpha beta nu lambda comma u r alpha beta lambda mu comma nu, we discover, or rather Bianchi discovered, that that's zero, that there is a symmetry of the Riemann tensor, of the differentiated Riemann tensor. Each of these expressions is a mess of derivatives of the metric. So I think it's not too hard to work that out for yourself, to do the calculation yourself and discover that it does all cancel, but it's not terribly exciting. But this is being done in the local inertial frame. In the local inertial frame, because that expression for the Riemann tensor in terms of the metric only applies in the local inertial frame. In the local inertial frame, however, these are in the local inertial frame, covariant differentiation is the same as ordinary differentiation. So in that frame, it turns out that we can turn these commas into semicolons. This is a trick we did also last time, because in the local inertial frame, the gammas that appear when we, in a sense, go the other way are all zero. But that is a tensor equation. So that although we worked out in a special frame, we've worked out a tensor equation in that special frame, which means that it's not just true. It's true not just in that special frame. Expression here is called the Bianchi identity, and it's used for at various times in the algebra of doing the calculations here to get rid of terms, rearrange things, and make things disappear. And if we do this contraction here on the Bianchi identities, we get a similar one, which I'll just write down so that it's on the sheet. Beta nu semicolon lambda plus, minus r beta lambda semicolon nu plus r beta nu lambda semicolon nu. The contracted Bianchi identity And if we can track that again, we get an expression G alpha beta semicolon beta equals zero. And you know, I'm missing out a lot of very boring algebra here, where this tensor G is formed from the Ricci tensor and the metric and the Ricci scalar. And this tensor here has this property that its covariant derivative is zero. And that tensor is called the Einstein tensor. And as you might not be astonished to discover, that tensor plays a quite significant part in what we are about to discover. But the Riemann tensor, there are lots of tensors happening here. The Riemann tensor is the one that we discovered contained all the information about how a vector changes as it goes around a path. So you plug your question in, this vector going around this path, you plug that data into the Riemann tensor, and what comes out is is information about how much that vector changes. And or else you talk about the tangents to two geodesics and the link joining them, you plug those in, and what comes out is information from the Riemann tensor about how much that connecting vector between these two geodesics, how much that changes. So there's a lot of information in the Riemann tensor. The Ricci tensor has fewer degrees of freedom. A lot of the of stuff has been contracted away. So there are, at a matrix, there are 4x4 components to the Ricci tensor, while there are 4x4x4x4 components to the Riemann tensor. But the Ricci tensor is, in a sense, all the bits of information in the Riemann tensor that you care about, it turns out. So that's the bit that matches most closely the stuff that is informative to us about the curvature of the space-time going through it. And this Einstein tensor is just a sort of adaptation, a sort of tweaked version of that Ricci tensor, which is the one with this interesting property, which is of significance to us. And having carefully got to, one reason why it's important to get through that section 4.1.2 on the energy momentum tensor, the previous thing, is that the punchline of the discussion of the energy momentum tensor is that the energy momentum tensor is such that on physical grounds, based on the idea that if you have a box, the total amount of momentum going into it must be the same as the total amount in the box minus anything coming out of it. And a mathematical statement of that is that the covariant derivative of the energy momentum tensor is zero. And the fact that this property of this energy momentum tensor describing the amount of energy, the amount of stuff in an area of space, that it has this this property here, and the fact that this tensor, the Einstein tensor, which is based on the curvature of the space time, has a similar property, is heavily hinting that these two things are very closely related to each other, and we'll discover that's true. We'll hold on to that thought because we want to come back to that. I keep forgetting I've got these quick questions, and then scrolling past them, it's you have these slides. It's very useful to have a think about those quick questions in the way I suggested in the past. Doing the mental what's my first reaction to this, then thinking about it and going up. I These questions are useful not just because they remind you what's going on, because they give you a bit of a break and stop you listening to me talking for an entire hour. Anyway, in the last couple of minutes, I'm going to just edge into. I'll start again from section 422, but the what we have now. Now we have all the materials that we can start doing physics again, because we have some mathematical objects which have properties that we can attach physical meaning to, and that have continuity conditions such as this little amount of energy momentum is conserved. That's a conservation law, which seems plausible. We have something which describes curvature in a way which we think is plausible. Now we have to work out what the relationship is between those. And the way we do that is by going back to the ideas that we talked about in part one, the very brief part one, where we talked about the things falling in lift shafts and things being free fall, and the idea of the local inertial frame being the one you're in when you're either away from all gravity or in free fall down a lift shaft or something similar. And what we discovered there is that you can make sense of all these things happening by talking about the equivalence principle. And I think we saw one or two versions of the equivalence principle in part one, which were basically to do with saying that the experience of being free fall and the experience of being not being in a gravitational field at all are equivalent. Not just hard to separate, not just impossible to separate, but they are actually the same thing. And so what we're going to do next is see two further versions of the equivalence principle, two further statements of the equivalence principle, which restate that in terms that we've, in slightly more sophisticated terms that we have available to us now, and also which tell us what to do next. And spoiler, what it tells us is that the physics that we understand in special relativity, which is basically Newton's physics, except with some tweaks. So the physics of our experience, the physics we understand when we jump up and down. It turns out that because of this, we can import that directly into the local inertial frame in a curved space-time. And because we can transform from that local inertial frame to anywhere else, we at that point can use the physics we understand in free fall and apply it in a curved space-time. And what that leaves us with is the problem of how precisely do we discover what the constraints are that matter applies to that space-time. In other words, how does matter change the curvature of that space-time? At which point, if we understand what the space-time is, what the shape of the space-time is, and can work out, and we haven't done this yet, can work out how things will move through that space-time, spoiler, it's long geodesics, then we have worked out how things move in a curved space-time, and we have reached our goal. So there's only a couple more steps to do, and each of those steps is in a way quite short, quite a small step at this point, because of all the work we've done about understanding geodesics, about understanding curvature, and understanding the metric. So this is where it all comes together to get Einstein's equations, which are, in a sense, the end point of where we are. So the next time I aim to get to the point where at least at to and beyond the point where we are talking about Einstein's equations, and we've got onto one simple solution. And all of GRG2 is solutions to Einstein's equation. I'll see you next time.